Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yesterday was our 12th annual Martin Luther King's birthday celebration. WNYC's Jamie Floyd and I co-hosted at the Apollo Theater. This year is tragically special, as it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. That happened on April 4th, 1968. So we focused on that and where King was at in the final phase of his work. He had moved on from fighting for the main civil rights laws, which had been passed, and had become really expansive in his politics of human equality. He had become an anti-Vietnam War activist and went from racial equality per se to his Poor People's Campaign on behalf of all low-income Americans of all races. Of course, poverty in the aftermath of slavery and Jim Crow and other discrimination for 400 years was disproportionately black, as it remains. We'll play some excerpts now from yesterday's event. Jamie and I had great guests to talk with. We'll start with some stretches from a panel hosted by Jamie, featuring King lawyer and confidant Clarence B. Jones, Brooklyn College politics professor Jean Theo Harris, a biographer of Rosa Parks, among other things she's written, and King biographer and historian Taylor Branch. We'll pick this up just after Jamie asked Taylor Branch, who's 70, where he was when King was killed, and did King's movement die with him?
We have to be truthful and honest about what that moment meant in Memphis. The movement was already coming apart. Even SCLC didn't stay together. Even his own organization couldn't stay together. But a lot of the movement organizations had already splintered. Dr. King was not at the forefront of American consciousness at the time when he was killed. That's another story. Having said that, the momentum that that movement set in train engendered what he called the widest liberation in human history, not just in the United States, but around the world, the freedom movement. And it liberated senior citizens and women and the white South and African Americans in many respects in the United States. To me, the key question is, why, if the freedom movement generated these blessings for so many groups in America, why do we live in a cynical age about the prospect of politics? And it's because we don't understand that that movement, the measure of American commitment to the equal citizenship and we the people, has always been race. At the few times that we've taken it seriously, we've leapt forward. But for the last 50 years, our discourse has been in denial about how central this is to democratic promise.
We're not having an honest conversation.
We're running from it. There are sadly a lot of people, if asked to choose in a pinch between their prejudices and the American Constitution, would take their prejudices. That's where we are. But the fact of the matter is that our involvement, if you care about American democracy, you should be talking about race. If you care about race, you should be plumbing the American experiment for weapons. That's what Dr. King did. He always put one foot in the scripture and one foot in the Constitution. And he built an incredibly broad movement. And that, to me, is the tragedy, that we've been in denial of the promise of that movement, even when we're harvesting all the blessings. I mean, one tiny thing. The year after Dr. King died, the national championship college football team from the University of Texas had a roster of 85 white players and no black players. Even college sports were still segregated at that time. And women couldn't go to Harvard, Yale, you know, all these things have changed. We accept those blessings. We don't ask where they came from. They came from because the racially led civil rights movement forced us to say, what do we really mean by equal citizenship? And we have forgotten that challenge or dodged it because people don't want to acknowledge a black-led movement as a model of modern political leadership.
Very Dr. Theo Harris, I do want to ask you about Coretta Scott King, because as I indicated, we always think about the grieving widow. When we, of course, think of Merle Evers, we think of that. I think Coretta Scott King is the archetypical grieving widow, but that's unfair, isn't it? I mean, she had not only the work that she believed in and of herself, but also continued the work of Dr. King. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the immediate aftermath of his assassination and the years thereafter.
Thank you. And I just to say, it is such an honor. I can't quite believe I'm here at the Apollo. I felt like I needed to say that. So, I think we've trapped her. There's that iconic picture of Coretta Scott King, right? Veiled, all in black, stoic. And I think we've trapped her behind that veil, and we haven't seen her, right? She is political before she meets him. Part of why they fall in love is because of that shared politics. In many ways, her kind of global vision, her peace vision, moves him. He will talk in the mid-60s. She's out against the war in Vietnam publicly, in large measure before him. A reporter asks him, after she gives a speech, did you educate her? He says, no, she educated me. And she, I mean, she shows a staggering fortitude, I think. Because 4 days later, she goes and leads the march in Memphis that he was supposed to lead. And then she picks up, right, so many strands of the movement. So it is her and many comrades across the country who take up the work of the Poor People's Campaign that spring. They go to D.C., right, to make poverty visible and to make it impossible to ignore poor people in this country, right? She is working on sort of and helping to sew kind of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement further together. And echoing what Mr. Jones was talking about, the FBI is, increases their surveillance of her in the aftermath of his assassination because of her kind of power and leadership, right? So in many ways, there's something embarrassing about how the FBI in 1969 is taking her leadership more seriously than we do today.
And as Dr. Jones indicated, they lived with that threat of death
throughout
the course of their marriage until his assassination, which means she too was living in fear, although with fortitude.
Absolutely, absolutely, right. She has 4 young kids. Many people talk about her being one of the reasons we have a Gary Convention in 1972, a national black convention. She takes sort of the movement for global justice forward around the divestment movement. She's out against the second Gulf War. I mean, she is sort of incredibly, in the 1970s, she says to a friend, I wish I could get more than 4 hours of sleep a night. I mean, she is everywhere. And I think she is a reminder, right, that the movement doesn't die, right? The movement is not over, even despite the tragedy that is Dr. King's assassination. And the movement is big, right? It's big. It's about voting rights. It's about anti-poverty. It's about sort of anti-imperialism. It's about criminal justice. And I think you when you watch Coretta Scott King, you see that and you... It gets us past the kind of just sitting in our feelings to sort of the movement carrying forward.
Taylor Branch, I have to ask you this question, although I ask it reservedly, knowing and having read your books. We're going to hear from Black Lives Matter in a bit. So 50 years after Dr. King's death and the movement that he led and was so much a part of, is there a danger in lionizing the icons? You notice I'm get ready, because when you come back out here with, I'm going to ask you this question too. Is there a danger in lionizing the icons of the movement? And does it hold us back and keep us from moving forward where we need to go today?
Well, there's always a danger if you try to fight the next movement by the rules and the heroes of the last movement. You've got to move forward. But right now, I don't think that we fully appreciate the power of that previous movement in order to begin getting out from where we are now, which is why do we have Trump in the White House, for God's sake? How did we sink this far? to not be able to talk about the constitutional promise and deal with race as the heart of the failed promise. We have this burden of race and we don't have the courage to lift it again to restore. That's what the movement did. I'd say that Black Lives Matter and a lot of the Dreamers, they're beginning movements, but they haven't come together in their own way, not the way that we would prescribe, to move the country the way that movement did before and influence the whole world and other people. So I'm hoping that we're at the end of a cycle where the Trump cycle has finally gone splat and we will finally realize that we need to take responsibility for restoring the hope of freedom.
Dr. Jones, how do we build the bridge from the movement of then to the people today who want to lead new movements now to the future?
I think the Black Lives Matter movement and Reverend William Barber II, the Moral Majority movement, they are the day's most relevant template, in my judgment, of carrying forward the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Now they have some areas to grow in, but basically they've captured the soul and content. Now you know this program is captioned Martin Luther King Jr., A Dream Deferred, and I heard earlier, you know what happens to a dream deferred, dries up like a raisin in the sun, quoting Langston Hughes' poem. And what we have to be concerned today, as I've said, we have to be careful that we don't trivialize and what I call minstrelize the legacy of this extraordinary man. Everybody talks about the dream. Now, the dream was really an effort. It was an aspirational example, holding up as an example to America what it could be. But the essence of the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. is Memphis, Tennessee, and those garbage workers. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's his essence. Mm-hmm. It ain't the dream. He was about the least of these. Mm-hmm. He was about the poor. And the celebrated speech, for example, that he gave opposing the war in Vietnam was, yes, he opposed the war in Vietnam because in terms of violence and so forth. But one of the basic reasons he opposed it is that the brother could count. You know, he knew that there was no way, notwithstanding anything that Johnson said, that there was going to be anything left for the war on poverty, because all the money was being spent in pursuit of the war.
We'll continue with more excerpts from our Martin Luther King birthday event at the Apollo Theater yesterday, including more from Dr. Jones, who was just speaking there, right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now more excerpts from our Martin Luther King event at the Apollo Theater yesterday. One of the guests from the previous panel, Dr. Clarence B. Jones, a contemporary of Dr. King, who was a lawyer for him and a speechwriter and a confidant, was such a special guest, we gave him his own stretch of time with both Jamie and me interviewing him. Here is a stretch of that, which begins with a question from WNYC's Jamie Floyd.
The young people now have the expression, stay woke.
Stay woke.
But, of course, you and Dr. King were aware of that because you were writing about remaining awake through a revolution back in 1968. Dr. King spoke words on that day that resonate on this day. One of the great liabilities of life, he said, is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping.
Through a revolution.
Through a revolution. Through a revolution.
That's right.
Dr. Jones, give us the context of those words as you and Dr. King contemplated them then and the resonance they have for us now.
Well, just for the record, it was his speech.
Mm-hmm,
I
mm-hmm.
made a minor contribution only in talking to him over the telephone. He had been invited, and we had talked the night before over the telephone. Just I hope everybody understood the context. This is March 31st, 1968, 5 days before his assassination. The speech is 11 o'clock in the morning. He's speaking at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. And he talks about the revolution really consisting of three major components: a revolution in technology, a revolution in dealing in war, values of war, and then the question of poverty. Poverty. I cannot tell you enough. I cannot emphasize enough the core of his legacy. And I just want to take 1 minute, if I may. I'll try to summarize. The core of his legacy is his concern about the fact, prophetically, that we have 5% of the world's population. We have 20% of the people incarcerated. We have 2.3 million people in jail. He would be concerned about the fact that 1 in 15 African Americans born in 2001 will end up in jail. He would be concerned that 1 in 3 African American babies born today in this century will end up in jail. He would be concerned about what, he didn't use that language, but his language can be interpreted, about the education, K through 12, school dropout, prisons of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He would be concerned about the least of these in Attica, in Angola, Louisiana, and the Mississippi State Penitentiary. He would be concerned about the least of these. He would be concerned that in the wealthiest nation of the world, Facebook, Intel, Apple, mass amount of wealth, we have people sleeping on the streets, homeless. You know, homeless in the wealthiest. No. Don't tell me. Well, they're homeless, you know, because they got drug addiction problems and they got this. Yeah, we know that. But you know what I say in Silicon Valley, which is just a mass of wealth. You know what I tell my friends? Build the homes and they will come. You know what I'm saying? Take your wealth and build the homes and they will come. Yeah, we know they got problems of addiction and so forth, but we don't need any more studies. We don't need any more don't waste any more monies getting people with PhDs and all sorts of writing reports. You don't need to know anything about coding. You don't know anything about logarithms. All you have to know is how to count. All you have to know is that if you take the money and adjust the problems, you can deal with it. I mean, if we can squander away $1 trillion in Afghanistan, and you can tell me we can't deal with the homeless? Hello? Am I speaking to people who are out here who can, you know, you can count, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and then by the way, it's difficult for me. I got this, I don't mean to be, it's difficult for me to, in the same stage this day, I heard that word Trump mentioned. Well, excuse me, don't mention Trump and King in the same word. That's an oxymoron.
I didn't say. It wasn't me.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Just use the word X or Y. No. Not on this day, on this holiday. It is a sacrilege. It's blasphemous. It is blasphemous to mention T-R-U-M-P in the same sentence with this extraordinary hero. Let me just tell you something. Hold on. In 12 years and 4 months, from 1956 and from April 4th, 1968, the date of his assassination, with the exception of the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 and the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr. may have done more to achieve political, social, racial justice and equality than any other single event or person in the 240-year history of the United States of America. And if that sounds like too much education words, well, let me put it in a 218 street. He was a bad dude.
Dr. Jones, yes. I want to pick up on something that you said in the last panel and have you talk a little bit about the history of that time, that period of time just before Dr. King's assassination, because there are a lot of young people in the audience here who weren't alive and maybe they didn't even learn it in school. You said in the earlier panel, Dr. King was not just about the dream.
Right.
He was about the least of us.
That's correct, the least
and
of these.
And he was the least of these. He was in Memphis to support sanitation workers on
right.
a strike as
right.
part of his poor people's campaign.
Right. That's what he was concerned about. Right.
So I wonder if you could educate those who don't already know a little bit about where Memphis fit into the arc, where the Poor People's Campaign fit into the arc of Dr. King's career.
Well, in 1967, and also in 1968, but particularly late he was concerned about addressing, calling attention to the nation, particularly Congress, to the plight of the poor. So he conceived of a Poor People's Campaign. Now, the astute author Taylor Branch earlier, that was a period of time when historically and factually, the movement was coming apart. SCLC was not organizationally at its best, but the fact of the matter is, Dr. King still kept his focus and wanted to bring poor people to the forefront. In fact, it was during that period that he developed what he called a guaranteed income for everyone, mm-hmm. Just the minimum income for everybody. It didn't matter what your ethnicity for. He'd come to the conclusion that in a nation as wealthy as this, that there should be a guaranteed minimum income for everybody who wakes up in the morning. Okay? So, now it was modest. So I'm trying to be responsive to your question.
Well, the Civil Rights Act had been passed 4 years earlier.
I'm sorry?
It was law. The Civil Rights Act.
Oh, yeah, the Civil Rights.
The Voting Rights Act.
That's right. Civil Rights Act in 1964. Voting Rights Act in 1965.
Yes.
And he was concerned about that.
Fair Housing Act, 67.
Fair Housing Act and so forth. And
so King's thinking evolved in new directions.
King's thinking, just to be repetitive, was what are we going to do about this enormous country of wealth? And what are we going to get the country and the government to focus on how to address the poverty, the fact that there were people who were poor? And he didn't say it, but I'll put it in 21st century terms. because I'm out in an area where everybody has a super education, PhDs in technology, and I just say, you don't need any more studies. We don't need any more commissions, you know. You don't need it, the most brilliant minds to look at something that is so obvious. What is the obvious? It's as obvious as the hand in front of your face. Extraordinary wealth and poverty. Extraordinary wealth, people sleeping in the streets. All right? So yes, we remember him by the dream. The dream was aspirational. But what we have to remember him today is that he would be both weeping and angry. He would say, I cannot abide, nor would he permit you to abide and to sit on your butts and do nothing about it. You understand? Now let me just talk. You talked about the Voting Rights Act, all right? He would be talking about, I think he would go back and talk about a famous speech by Frederick Douglass, power can seize nothing without a demand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It never will, it never has and never will, and so forth. And he would say, the most powerful thing we have is voting. The most powerful thing we have,
that's right,
is block by block, precinct by precinct, mm-hmm, neighborhood by neighborhood, county by county, state by state, registered to vote. Now I'm going to talk to my activist young people, okay? I love your energy and your anger, okay? But if you're going around raising placards and screaming and you ain't got a voter registration card,
bravo,
in your pocket,
bravo,
then sit down. You don't have nothing to say. You understand? I have seen and visited people in the hospital. People in the hospital who got their heads beaten simply because they wanted to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were an activist, if you're an activist, in fact, they should create a button that says RV, registered voter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if a person protesting and they don't have an RV button, get on and get away, because you're not going to hear nothing you got to say. Because that means you're just selling whoop tickets. You understand? Or putting in blip, like you're just selling a lot of book. You understand? I'm putting language that you can understand. It's about, you know, it's about power. And the hour is late. I was like, we can't. You worry about this T-R-E-U-M-P? Excuse me, don't worry about them. V-O-T-E. You know, V-O-T-E, you know what you can do? Get yourself a pair of sharp-toed shoes and put a vote on it, and then put your V-O-T-E up his butt. That's,
ladies,
non-violently, excuse me.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank for his words, for his life, for his inspiration today, Dr. Clarence B. Jones. Dr. Clarence B. Jones, lawyer, confidant, speechwriter for Martin Luther King, and we'll continue with more excerpts from our Martin Luther King's birthday event at the Apollo Theater yesterday, right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. At our King Day event at the Apollo yesterday, one of the panels was with three women leading social justice movements. Linda Sarsour, who was one of the four main organizers of the Women's March on the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump last year. I'll ask her how that looks a year out. She was formerly head of the Arab American Association of New York. Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. And journalist and activist Rosa Clemente, among other things, the Green Party vice presidential candidate in 2008. And you may have seen her at the Golden Globes last week. Some of the stars brought activists as their guests to make a point about the Me Too movement. And Susan Sarandon brought Rosa Clemente. I invited them each to reflect on the intersectionality of their work, fighting both patriarchy and white supremacy. Linda Sarsour speaks first.
First of all, I just want to say I'm so honored and humbled to be here today, and especially an honor in the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. And what I will say to folks in this room is Donald Trump didn't introduce patriarchy or misogyny or sexism or racism or xenophobia or homophobia to me. Welcome to everyone else that woke up on November 9th of 2016. For me, I just want to be really clear. We talk a lot about this women's movement and feminism and patriarchy. I'm part of a woman-led movement that is for everyone. This is a movement that is being led by women, and anyone who trusts the leadership of women is part of the movement that I'm a part of. I'm not part of a movement that excludes anyone, including male allies, my son, my partner, my father, my brother, my grandfather. We are all in this together at this moment. So we gotta be in this together. And at the root of every problem that we have, patriarchy, xenophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, I can take you down the list. White supremacy is the foundational issue and has always been the foundational issue. So if you want to be down with the movement that we are a part of, this is not just necessarily a movement against patriarchy, it's a movement to dismantle white supremacy in this country. And that's how we're going to create the real country that we all know we have the potential to be. So if you're in it with us, we are a woman-led movement that is out to dismantle white supremacy.
Rosa Clemente.
Well, first was good Harlem, you know, while it's still a little bit black, because who knows how it's going to be in 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. But, and I got to touch this. I can't believe it. Like, oh, my God, what's happening? Look, I'm a Bronx-born Afro-Boricua, black Puerto Rican woman. Grew up in New York City, and first for all my non-gender conforming people, and all the queer folks, and all the young folks who've been putting their bodies on the line, thank you. Because I think you're fulfilling the radical dream that Dr. King had. And it was funny because I looked at how they titled this in our call sheet, and it said Women and Modern Movements. Like women haven't been in movements forever, have not been leading, have not been fighting. You know, so I think for me, the work is now about how we build a youth to movement pipeline. I don't think that we can wait till young people are exposed after 18 or 21 in a college environment or a work environment to deal with issues of white supremacy, patriarchy, and really the overarching to all of this is capitalism. We live in a society where everything is monetized, where everything is monetized, our bodies, our work, our looks, where we live and how we live, right? Our food, all of it, environmental justice, all of that. And where we're really seeing all of this intersect is in Puerto Rico, where my people have been abandoned, forgotten, not only by the government, not only by both parties, but by most people who are in movements, right? So to me, we can't just use intersectionality as the thing that's hot and a trend right now. Because a lot of times in this movement work, things become real trendy, but the most marginalized people are still forgotten.
That's right.
Even though the most marginalized people are always the center of movements and power. And I think it's just very important that we, as we continue to do our work, whether it's been 15, 20, 25 years, that we start teaching our babies from the time they come out of the womb to understand these systems, because the system kills 7-year-olds like Ayanna Jones and 12-year-olds like Tamir Rice, and the system killed Erica Garner. So we gotta teach them from the time they're coming out that they are part of this movement, that is not an add-on to your life, that it is your life.
Patrice Cullors.
I'm so grateful to be here, honored to be on this panel. I think this is the first time we're on a panel together. Linda, same with you. I think it's the first time we're on a panel together. I just want to take a moment to honor all the work and all the labor and the centuries of fight for black liberation in this country and throughout the world. when black people get free, everybody gets free. And, you know, this question about patriarchy and our movements and legacy, the first people I think about when I think about the fight against patriarchy is Ella Baker. I think about Harriet Tubman. I think about Fannie Lou Hamer. I think about Shirley Chisholm. I think about all the black women who labored invisible, whose labor was invisible. It took this, you know, decade and our movement moment to actually lift up Ella Baker's name, to know that she was actually the architect of the civil rights movement. And she had a significant amount of tensions with the idea of this MLK as a messiah. And we live in a culture that's deeply obsessed with seeing one single individual, usually a man, to lead us to freedom. And that's actually never how it's been. There's always been women, mostly women of color, specifically black women, who figured it out, helped us survive, and helped us thrive. And I think as long as we are a part of the generation that honors us and is committed to that honor and is committed to saying, no, actually, this is who's doing this work, we're going to win.
So I was thinking, listening to you just now say this is the first time you've been on a panel with Rosa and with Linda, that because of the truly all-star nature of this panel, if maybe each of you might have a question for one of the others of you and give you the moderator power.
Brian, that's your job.
I'm like, no, I love that idea.
I've got a million questions, but I'd like to share it. Patrice, anything that you would like to ask of these two by way of their work or the connections between your work or just anything you're curious about?
Yes, actually. I'm like, I love that idea. I want to ask you a question, Rosa, because you just spoke specifically about the youth to movement pipeline. And I want to know, just given your own experience in this movement, why you feel like that's important and why you're sort of creating that term and trying to bring that conversation to light.
Yeah, I mean, even though I grew up in the Bronx, you know, in the 70s, the creation of hip hop, and in my latter years, I grew up in Westchester County, just, you know, 18 miles from here. It wasn't until I went to the State University of New York at Albany that I even knew that Puerto Rico was a colony, that I knew about political prisoners, that I heard the word the Black Panther Party or the Young Lords. And I remember coming home and asking my parents, like, how am I speaking Spanish, grew up proud to be Puerto Rican, went to the parade, got family, go everywhere, and I don't know anything about my history or my people. And I remember taking one specific class with a professor by the name of Dr. Vivian Verdell Gordon that was in the academy, one of the first women to write about this intersection of the race, gender, and class within black women. And she told me, don't be mad at your parents, right? Because there's a reason they hid the strength and resistance of Puerto Rico. Mm. So for me, I said, I think it was too late for me to learn that at 20. Mm. So when I have my daughter, even when they brought the birth certificate and they checked Hispanic, I said, you can give me another birth certificate. She's not Hispanic. Mm. She is a black Puerto Rican. They said, we don't have a category. I said, well, you're gonna have one now.
Yes.
By the way, I went to Albany too. So don't let anybody tell anybody that you can't get a good education at a state university.
Oh, it's the best education ever.
Anybody else want to play? Rosie, you got one for any of them? All right, I got one. For you, Linda. It's been a year just about now since the Women's March on the day after the inauguration. How's the resistance?
The resistance is alive and well and breathing, Ryan. What I will say, just on a personal level, as someone who is a part of the resistance, is that it's, for me personally, it's been the best year of my life, but it's been the worst year of my life. And as we think about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and the whitewashing of who he was and what he stood for, and thinking about who we are and the things that we're going through, I want people to realize that Dr. Martin Luther King wasn't this like man that was bringing white people and black people together. He was a black radical revolutionary who was spied on by the US government. The FBI at the time called him one of the most dangerous men in America. He wrote us letters from the Birmingham jail. He was a victim of police brutality. He was vilified. And only decades after his death did we now all of a sudden everyone wants to memorialize Dr. Martin Luther King. So I say that to say that many of us who are on the front lines and all of us on the stage, nobody wants to be us right now. We have been met with vicious, vulgar, dangerous attacks by the opposition, and especially because we are women, and especially because we are women of color. Mm-hmm. They see some sort of vulnerability from us. And what we're saying to them is we are not afraid, and we are not intimidated. And the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and the women that organized with Dr. Martin Luther King is that they believed in the sanctity and the dignity of black life and the life of all human beings, and that's what we believe in this resistance. So when you're thinking about the things that you see and the protesting and the civil disobedience that we're engaging in, just remember that we're also mothers and we have children, and that our children deserve to live safely in this country, and that we do not and should not have to sacrifice as much as we do, but because we fight not just for our children, but for yours too. So when I think of Dr. Martin Luther King, I think of sacrifice. I think of pain and trauma and the many months and weeks that his children were without their father. And I think about the same for myself, the many times where I think about my own children and who my children are and what they're feeling in this moment when we live in a country that tells my beautiful Muslim children that they don't belong here, mm-hmm. that their faith doesn't belong here. And it is my responsibility not only to fight for them on the streets or in the halls of Capitol Hill, but also at home, and fight for them to say you are worthy and you are beautiful and that I love you and our country will be forced to love you. So I want to offer that it's hard out here. It's not easy. And a lot of times we see the glam of the work right. that we do. People see, you know, Rosa on the red carpet at the Golden Globes. They see me on the cover of Glamour magazine. They see Patrice got a new book out now mm-hmm. that you all better buy us out in the hallway mm-hmm. somewhere. And people think it's a glamorous life, but we want you to know that pray for us and pray for our families and support the women of color who are putting their lives on the line for all of you and for all of us. And I ask you also to be courageous, that when you hear something, that you stand up for us and you say that you will not take these sisters out, because these sisters are standing in the legacy of freedom fighters in these United States of America, and we are proud of the work that we are doing, and we are going to keep doing the work that we are doing because we believe in what we are doing, and we will demand that this country love us the way that we love our country.
Patrice, talk about your book a little bit. And one thing about it is that you put the word, is it terrorist or terrorism? Terrorist.
Terrorist.
In the title, mm-hmm. which is a word that's usually overly applied to Linda's people these days. Why'd you put it in a book by the co-founder of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah. Thank you, Linda, for that word. Well, I think what's important that for folks to understand, and in the book, I'm really hitting on a few themes. One is mass incarceration, the war on drugs, the war on gangs, and that while Black Lives Matter was called a terrorist organization, the co-founders of Black Lives Matter were called terrorists, black people have been called terrorists for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, the language around terrorism was designated for black people in this country and has now evolved because there's that's the way white supremacy works, right? Everybody has a potential to become a target unless you're white. And so when they call you a terrorist, really details a coming of age story. What makes someone turn into an activist? What makes someone end up putting their body on the line, their life on the line? And also the different ways in which not only I was called a terrorist, but the people in my family labeled as terrorists, as domestic terrorists, gang members, and you know, legal language, the other term for gang members is domestic terrorists. And so the book is powerful. I still can't believe I wrote a book. I'm really grateful for all the support that it's received thus far. You can get it in the lobby, but more importantly, I'm trying to have a conversation with this country in this moment. We are living in a dangerous moment. It is not only scary to just be alive, it's scary to be an organizer, an activist. And I think we need inspiration. The book is about survival. I'm still here.
That's right.
Black folks are still here. And it takes a level of creativity and genius to still be alive when something continues to try to kill you.
And what's the focus of Black Lives Matter now? I think it came, you know, so much into the public awareness for a few years there. You, I believe, were personally at one of the Bernie Sanders campaign events where you made sure that Black Lives Matter was a thing. Some people did it at a Hillary Clinton campaign event. Probably nobody even bothered to do it at a Donald Trump campaign event. And yet, here we are. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think we hear more about football players kneeling during the national anthem in the press these days than we do about the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
So where's
you
it at?
We'll be walking down Colin Kaepernick Boulevard in 30 years, I promise you that.
Tell the truth. Tell the truth, girl. BLM, just like any movement, has its moment in the spotlight. I think for so many of us, we understand that the spotlight and media attention is not the only way you become a movement. I remember going to schools telling folks, I'm gonna be here when Black Lives Matter is trendy, and I'm gonna be here when it's not trendy.
That's right.
This is my life. I created Black Lives Matter out of a call for urgency, and this time is still urgent.
Yes.
Black people are still being killed by law enforcement. Black people are still dying in custody. Black women are still dying when they're giving birth to their children, and the year after they give birth to their children. Let's look at Erica Garner, right? There is still a crisis of anti-Black racism in this country, so Black Lives Matter is alive more than ever. And I think that we have to be careful, both media, but also us, you know, in the room, on the stage. We have to be careful that when the cameras aren't there, that we don't become discouraged. Many folks in our movement, many reporters have said to me, where is Black Lives Matter? I haven't heard about y'all. I'm like, that's your question. Yeah.
Where are you?
Where are y'all? Because we're here.
We're gonna
be here. Folks are still protesting, folks are still marching, people are sitting with elected officials, they're building out legislation. The Black Lives Matter organization and movement is alive and well, and I feel like it's such an honor and privilege to be a part of this movement. It's an honor of privilege to be challenging this current administration in this moment.
And can I just say, because I know we're wrapping up, like, you know, I'm a little bit older than Patrice and Linda, and I've been super blessed to have spent, I mean, quality time. Me and Patrice lived right next to each other for a year while this was, BLM was rising. And, you know, I said, I don't want to be like that little bit older person, but one of the things we have to do is, and no, as folks that we're called stars, which I don't like, you know, limelight, visibility is not power. Visibility is not power. So yes, I might have been at the Golden Globes last Sunday, but I was telling people, we walked that red carpet, but we were working that red carpet.
Right.
We weren't just there. But then part of it was like, there are moments where we should have joy in resistance. Mm. There are moments we need to celebrate. Mm. But, you know, I would just say this, that I think it's very important that if you are a woman in this work, non-gender conforming, queer, that you check in on your people. Right. There are times where I will be like, Linda, you good? Do I have to come down? Do we got to go to dinner? Mm-hmm. Patrice, you good? And they do the same for us. Even though sometimes our political Black liberation line, we might find a different way of doing it, that should never break the bonds of sisterhood.
Right.
Ever break the bonds. And we got to support each other. We gotta love each other, and we always have to check in on each other and make sure that we got each other's back. Because straight up, this woman, Linda, is enduring death threats, okay? Death threats. People are trying to kill her. We realize that. People trying to kill her. I don't even put myself in that category because I have not gone through the extent of what these two to my left and right have gone through. But I know that in movement work, when you're on those front lines, you can't just have people who are just going to be around you when the times are good.
Right.
Right? Sisterhood.
That's a word.
Linda Sarsour, Patrice Cullors, and Rosa Clemente at our Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday event at the Apollo Theater yesterday. Thanks for listening today, everyone. A special thanks to the great people at the Apollo Theater for partnering with us on this each year. And special thanks to WNYC's Brenda Williams-Butts, who's really been the driving force behind our 12 consecutive years of this. Yesterday was the first one Brenda missed, because she's one of the many, many people to get hit with whatever is going around right now, and rest was the better part of valor yesterday. But the invisible hand of every year's King Weekend event has been Brenda Williams-Butts, so listeners, now you know her name. We'll conclude after all those conversations, as we did at the event, with some music from the fabulous group Vi Higginson's Gospel for Teens. Thanks for listening.
Lay down my burdens down, down, down by the riverside.